Welcome to episode number 110 of the Video Game History Hour, presented by the Video Game History Foundation. Every episode, we bring in an expert guest, someone who's done their research or lived through it and has an interesting story from video game history to tell. My name is Kelsey Liu, and I'm the co-director of the Video Game History Foundation, and I'm here, as always, with Frank Cifaldi, the founder and co-director of the Video Game History Foundation.
Joining us today is author Kyle Orland, who is apparently being taken away by ambulance as we speak. I guess the show's over. That would have been edited out, but maybe it shouldn't be. Kyle is here today to talk to us about Minesweeper, both the ubiquitous Microsoft Windows game and the title of his book from Boss Fight Books, which is released digitally, what, today? Is it literally today?
That the Kickstarter backers are getting it as we record this. And yeah, you'll be able to buy it from the Boss Fight Bookstore in mid-May and physical copies as well.
Incredible. So
he's also my Boss Fight Book season buddy.
That's true.
Yeah.
Welcome to
my book's coming out way later this year, but it's
everyone on this podcast is a Boss Fight Books author from this particular season, except for me.
That's true.
About a 3 a.m. That goes.
So, just straight off the bat, I mean, so Minesweeper, hopefully everyone listening to this knows what this is, but this is a game that's that was embedded into Windows operating systems forever, possibly still. I've never checked, to be honest. It's a game that basically everyone I've ever met has played. And it's one that, you know, I don't think until you, anyone had thought about.
it's weird. When I was thinking of what to pitch to Boss Fight Books, I thought of games that I played a lot. And, you know, obviously, like anyone of my generation, I'm 40. I think if you grew up with a computer before the internet, you probably stumbled across Minesweeper at some point, and you at least clicked around and tried to figure out how to play. You know, I figured out there were 4 billion copies distributed with versions of Windows in the 20 years that they did it, between Windows 3.1 in 1992, and then I think they stopped with Windows 8. So 4 billion copies, you know, it's been played easily hundreds of millions of hours.
And I just opened the games, Microsoft Casual Games thing that I've never opened on my computer, which I believe is Windows 10, and Minesweeper is still there, just so we're all clear. It's still happening.
Did you downloaded this from, or was this built in to the?
It goes up on my, like, just search already. I mean,
to download it.
I bet. Yeah. Click through. Right. I want to see what happens, actually, because I haven't tried.
It downloaded an update. It downloaded an update, but didn't say it was downloading the entire thing.
Okay, maybe you've downloaded it in the past, but yeah. Whether it's pre-installed versus whether you have to go to the Windows Store to download it was a big thing that I talked about with some of the people at Microsoft. They kind of moved it over because they wanted to promote the Windows Store. They're like, oh, what do we have that will get people to use this Windows Store? Oh, well, people love Solitaire and Minesweeper. Let's take those off the start menu and put them on the Windows Store. And, you know, that kind of worked. People did look for them on the Windows Store, but they were also annoyed that they had to look for them on the Windows Store.
Okay, I just confirmed you do have to download Minesweeper. You don't have to download the thing that says Solitaire and Casual Games.
Yes, but then they added Solitaire back.
Minesweeper, you do have to download it.
So. Oh, God. I thank you for confirming that, because I was going to have to recall all of the books and be like, oh, I made a mistake.
So 4 billion, was that the number?
Yeah, when it comes to the ratio of hours played to number of words written, I challenge you to find any game that's larger than Minesweeper.
Sure, that was my thinking. I'm wondering, install base, is it maybe just Solitaire that has beaten the install base of this game?
That's probably true. If you're talking about distinct installed copies, I mean, it would have to be something that, like, shipped with an iPhone to beat it at this point. And there's no pre-installed game like that. So,
and if there is, it changes every generation, I'm sure. So yeah.
Yeah. It's really a generational thing too. It's kind of like, Oregon Trail a little bit, you know, people refer to the Oregon Trail generation. I feel like there's a Minesweeper generation of people who were introduced to PC gaming at a certain point in history, just pre-internet, or when the internet was just starting to come into homes. And it was a pretty unique time in gaming where, you know, after the internet came around, oh, okay, there's a lot of free games on, you could connect with people. Early on, you know, Minesweeper was really the easiest access you had to a game without having to drive to a store, look at these big boxes, pay $40 for some, you know, intense RPG or simulation. It was really, you know, the start of casual gaming before that was even a thing.
Yeah, I mean, what was the world like around the time that Minesweeper was being introduced? Like, did households have computers? Did they play games on their computers? Like, what was the world it was introduced into?
Yeah, not really. People still thought of computers at that time as, like, expensive productivity tools that you might have in a professional office or, you know, if you were at a university. You know, they were coming down in price, but there was still thousands of dollars in early 90s dollars to get even, you know, basic 486 or later a Pentium. So these were not, it was not quite mass market yet, but also there was this team inside Microsoft that was starting to think about, okay, is there a home market for this? Can we get, you know, upscale professionals to buy this for their house? And, you know, maybe we can convince them, oh, it'll be good for your kids' homework. Or, oh, you can, you know, use the CD-ROM encyclopedia in the mid-90s. And games they saw as kind of a wedge to get the kids interested in it too, not just the parents. And so they had a few casual games that they could throw in. You know, it wasn't really in Microsoft's DNA to be the game publisher that it is now, but they had these things, as I go into in the book, where employees were just kind of making these off the record kind of free time projects to learn how to code in Windows, and they were floating around and they said, hey, let's make an entertainment pack out of these. And, you know, the rest was history.
I mean, that tends to be where games just come from, right? Like, what can I do with this thing? And just as humans, we gravitate toward play. So yeah, it makes complete sense that Microsoft engineers in their tucked in shirts with their ties are as they're practicing how to engineer in, I don't know, Visual Basic or whatever, mm-hmm. that they would gravitate toward making games. So, I mean, is that kind of where Minesweeper came from? Was there just like a giant pile of stuff within Microsoft, and then someone decided, hey, maybe we should sell this?
Yeah, so Minesweeper specifically, you can trace it back pre-Windows. There's a whole line of games that were very similar, kind of hunt and find games, maybe inspired a little bit by Battleship, you know, and you see them, you know, in the 70s and 80s, really copying game concepts was really the norm. So someone would see an earlier game and they'd be like, oh, okay, I'll make that. And maybe I'll tweak a few things. So the early ones had you actually walking through the minefield, sometimes from the upper left corner to the bottom right. And they would slowly introduce things like, you know, oh, you can see what's adjacent to you, but then maybe you can add diagonals, maybe you can add mouse controls, maybe we'll add a little bit more of the user interface being a little nicer. And that gets us to, you know, the early 90s. A couple of guys at Microsoft are trying to learn how to program in OS2, actually. I don't know if anyone remembers Microsoft's other visual operating system before Windows.
No one remembers that.
It was kind of an IBM Microsoft co-production. Yeah. And so there was a version of early version of Minesweeper made for that. Another guy at Microsoft uses that to start his Windows skills. And yeah, he basically just throws this on the internal network. It's not all that original. It's a copy of a bunch of other games, but now that there's a Windows version that everyone at Microsoft can play, it kind of goes viral in that environment. I talk in the book about how Bill Gates got addicted to it, and his future wife, Melinda Gates, had to urge people to tell him lies about the world record, because otherwise he would waste too much important company CEO time on this game. So once they found that, I guess they knew they had lightning in a bottle.
I want to go through that story real quick, just because I think it's,
it's
a great anecdote.
Yeah.
So, I mean, well, first of all, I mean, this was already becoming a time waster. Like, even Bill Gates aside, this was becoming a time waster at Microsoft, just among engineers, right? Like, was just something that people were getting into. I felt a little bit better because you mentioned in the book that that there were even some employees there who were ostensibly smart people who just kind of thought it was a random clicking guessing game and didn't get it, which was my experience as a child. I never really learned what Minesweeper was.
This is such an incredibly common thing I've found. The two reactions I get when people hear I'm writing a book about Minesweeper is, I wasted hundreds of hours on that game. You know, it cost me my graduate degree, or, you know, I was procrastinating with it. Or, oh, I remember I tried that for 5 minutes and I couldn't figure it out, and it just seemed weird. Those are really the two diametrically opposed things. You know, there was a help file in there that you can go in, and it does a pretty good job actually explaining the basics of the game, but, you know, no one really looked at the help file. For me, my mom was actually the one who taught me how to play the game. I think, you know, I've been taken to work one day for one of those, you know, I didn't have childcare or something. So she just sat me down in front of the computer while she was at meetings and was like, here, you know, amuse yourself. And, you know, there was no internet connection at the time. This was the early 90s that, you know, I could play around with Paint or the word processor, I guess. And then I looked in this games folder. I'm like, oh, what's Minesweeper? And like you, Kelsey, I clicked around a bit and I saw the numbers and I'm like, I don't know what these mean. And when my mom came back in, I was like, Mom, what is this? And, you know, I don't know where she learned it from. Maybe she actually read the help file. But she actually explained to me, you know, what that meant and, you know, how to the basics of the logic, which, you know, I was like 10 years old at the time. I was like, oh, okay, you can, you know, figure this out to use this, you can use this information to figure out more information. And it started to click for me. And, you know, I probably wasted that whole day just getting better and figuring out from like first principles how to solve even a basic Minesweeper board. And I guess I was at that age where it really made me feel smart. It made me feel like I'd accomplished something. And then that little high score box comes up and it gives you the time. And I'm like, oh, okay, I can do that faster. And then you're done with beginner and you can like, okay, now I can do the intermediate. I can do expert. So I guess it really came to me at the right point in my life to become an obsession for a little bit. And then I would come back to it, you know, at various times in my life, like 5 years, like, oh, I haven't played Minesweeper for a while. And then I play one game and, you know, for the rest of the year, I would be back into it again until I reached another plateau.
I mean, it's almost a perfect Tetris-like game design.
It's definitely the kind of thing where you, if you play it for a while, you'll see mines everywhere, kind of right. Like the Tetris effect. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it kind of scratches the same itch as, I don't know, a crossword or something, except that by its very nature, there are, you know, near infinite permutations of the board that are automatically generated for you. And there is infinite potential for you to grow as a player by getting faster. And it's, I don't know, it's just a perfect little game, I feel like, which... it's probably how Bill Gates felt about it. And
I compare it a little more to Sudoku.
Okay, for sure.
Crosswords have a lot of creativity to them. You know, there's puzzles are designed by humans. This is just kind of a random algorithm. It's funny. You actually, if you look on Amazon for Minesweeper, you'll find these like pre-printed books now where it's like a grid where they have the mines and you have to put the numbers in place there are some numbers and some mines and you have to put the mines in the place to satisfy the rules like Minesweeper.
Oh, so interesting. Like reverse Minesweeper.
Yeah, a little bit. They've turned it into a pen and paper puzzle in a way. I guess that would count as a demake. Yeah. I think these are like algorithmically generated by some Chinese paper mill or something, but it was really interesting when I was doing research for the book. I was like, what other books have been about Minesweeper? And it was these puzzle books. I was like, oh, did Minesweeper come from these puzzle books? And, you know, no, it seems to have started in like the last 5 years. These puzzle books came from the video game Minesweeper. And they're even using the name Minesweeper as kind of the shorthand everyone knows for, oh, it's like a tile-based game, and you have these adjacency rules, and people immediately get that. It
doesn't break the trademark if there's a space between the words.
I don't think Microsoft, if they have registered for a trademark, they're not enforcing it at all. There are so many clones out there where it's like, it's just become a genericized, it's the escalator, it's the Kleenex, you know. Everyone knows what you mean.
Oh, I didn't know escalator was one of those.
Oh, yeah.
You learn dumpster, something new every day.
There's a lot out there.
Oh, okay. I always go for the Kleenex one. I didn't know that was a, all right.
Add Minesweeper to the list.
Add Minesweeper to the list. Or Minecraft, as I'm probably going to call it at some point.
Stop. You're not going to do it. You're not going to do it.
I wrote Minecraft so many times when I was writing my notes.
I definitely relate. I wrote a lot of Minecraft. If you looked at the first draft of this book, you'd have to, before I hit Control F for Minecraft and got rid of them all. It'd be a little embarrassing.
I think another factor that contributed to this game's success, as it were, is the fact that it was mouse driven, and it's almost like a tutor to learn how to use this new concept. At least for people who weren't previously Mac owners, right? Which is the mouse, right. And especially the two buttons on a mouse, which was actually new, right?
Yeah, two button mouse, and it's pretty perfect for that because the right button flags where mines can be, and the creator said that was, he really wanted something that could use both buttons, and he kind of came up with that for it. But yeah, you talk about, we take it for granted now that, oh, the mouse, it's, you know, it's so easy to use. But I talked to one of the people at Microsoft where they would do trainings, and people would like pick up the mouse and put it on the wall or put it on the monitor like it's a pointing device. Like, oh, I have to put it directly on what I see on the screen. Like, no, you put it down on the floor or the desk. Putting it on the floor is probably something else.
Floor.
Unless you're working.
What I always heard was like trying to use it like a remote. So just like very early Wiimote on.
Oh, can you imagine if they had actually shipped it with, you know, an infrared remote instead of, and that became the standard instead of the mouse?
I mean, it is the thing that people like knew what to do with at the time. So like that, I don't know. Every time I hear that, I'm like, that makes perfect sense. Like you already have a TV with a remote and like, this is, I don't know. Why wouldn't you think it does the same thing?
Were people using laser pointers at that point too in like their presentations?
Ooh,
they might be.
I don't know.
I don't see why they wouldn't. I feel like that's old technology, but yeah. I couldn't say for sure.
Well, that's a little bit of a tangent here, but yeah, I would love to. I'd love to see a Wiimote controlled version of Minesweeper. Now that you mentioned that, I don't know. Whenever I use the Wiimote, I find like if my hand is shaking at all, then it's going to go off and I'm going to click one square over from where I want to and then blame the remote.
You don't want to make Minecraft.
Yeah, that's no.
Minesweeper.
That sounds like it would not. Did you say
Minecraft?
He
said Minecraft.
Who did?
You.
You did.
I did? Oh, boy. Yeah.
Rewind the tape. Rewind the tape.
Wow.
One square over from where I want to and then blame the remote.
You don't want to make Minecraft.
Yeah, that's...
No.
Enhance.
You don't want to play Minecraft this way. No.
Now, back to the podcast.
You know, it's funny. I'm looking at the word Microsoft on my screen.
I think that's part of it.
Microcraft.
Like you've got Microsoft Minesweeper, and so you have already that like CR. I don't know.
They also own Minecraft now. They've just cornered the mine market.
Real crossover potential, I feel. So this is a big part of your book, and you know, we don't need to get into all of the details of your book. In fact, please go buy the book, everyone. We will link to the ability to do that in the show notes. But a little bit of an important part of the story. Tell us about the extremely sterile sounding entry business unit at Microsoft.
Yeah, these were the people that were tasked with kind of creating a home market for PCs, for Windows PCs at the time, and trying to convince people, you know, hey, this isn't just for office work. This isn't just for science nerds. This is something that you can put on your desk at home. And like I said, games were kind of the wedge to convince kids that this was something they might actually want. I think one of the people in the book says, you know, if we knew if we could get kids interested in Windows, they would just, if then they would just bug their parents, like, I want a PC, I need a PC, there's games on it, these, I want to play these games. And the parents would be like, oh, well, okay, they want to play games, and they maybe will use it for homework, and so maybe we should actually spend this huge amount of money on something that we've never even considered before.
There was definitely like a sentiment at the time, I feel like, of computers are going to be a very important thing that every child is. And I mean, to be fair, it was true. Like,
yeah.
Computers are a very important thing that every child is going to need to know because it's going to be a big part of their life in the future. I don't know. You had a line in there that I liked that was something about how if you didn't have games on a PC, it would be like relying on kids to buy broccoli for the house or something like
yeah.
that. And it's like, you know, you have to actually make it appealing to the kids too.
A little bit like that, yeah. But also at the same time, you know, this was years before the first version of DirectX even. So programming games on Windows was very rudimentary. It was a little bit like Visual Basic. You're kind of limited in what you could do. You couldn't do real complex animations. It was all about, you know, clicking areas and moving sprites very simply. So that kind of limited you to a certain style of what we would now call casual games, you know. And Microsoft really wasn't in the games business at the time. They had Flight Simulator, I guess, which you could kind of count as a game. And I think there was Microsoft Lynx, their golf game, at some point in this history. But that was about it. And those were like games for, you know, 50-year-olds, hobbyists, not for kids. No kid was getting excited about Flight Simulator at that time. So, yeah, along with Minesweeper, there were a bunch of these other just free time games floating around the Microsoft network, some of them, you know, more successful than others. And the entry business unit's like, hey, can we just throw these together? You know, a few of them put in a screensaver as well, which didn't ship with Windows, and just call it the Microsoft Entertainment Pack, and we'll ship it for $40. And it, you know, they were desperate for any Windows software at that point. This was, you know, early days, Windows 3, Windows 3.1. They were trying to convince people to upgrade from DOS as well. So, you know, so they've spent all this money on a computer. Why do we have to spend extra money, get a new operating system that, you know, we're used to the DOS command line. We've learned this, have to learn a new operating system. Well, games can be something like, oh, here's something you can do that's a little more graphical than the average DOS game. It shows off the mouse, the drag and drop interface, things like that. So yeah, it was kind of a skunkworks project. They threw it together really quick. I think it was 10 months from pitch to shipping, which, you know, even for something simple like this was extremely rushed, as we talk about in the book. And then it turned into a giant hit.
I mean, let's be clear too, that the idea of like a capital G gamer, you know, playing games on Windows, it's not really a thing. You know, like Windows will launch native DOS apps, right? But at the time, exactly, like Windows was taking all of your precious resources away from your computer in order to just run. Mm-hmm. And so there were technically games written for native Windows 3.1, but if you compare, you know, those games to like what's happening in pure DOS, it's just, you know, there's no comparison. Like,
yeah.
Like Windows is just not performant enough for games at this point.
There was a backward compatibility issue too, because if you had Windows, you could run any DOS game still. You could launch into DOS very easily and just you know, type in a few words and be running the game. If you had DOS, you were not going to be able to play any Windows games. So it's, you know, it's kind of the console generation problem every time, where you've got this established base of gamers who are used to one thing. You got to convince them to upgrade. You need a system seller almost to get them to upgrade. And you know, that's when it's not a gaming console. Windows is about a lot more than just games, but they needed something, you know, before DirectX to show, hey, there's something to gaming on Windows. You don't have to stay with DOS. There's some things it can do.
It struck me not as like talking to people who want games, it struck me more as almost creating new computer gamers. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. hey, if you get this this software for, I mean, it's so interesting because it's a we just got Lane Nooney's book in the mail today. Okay. You know, about the sort of introduction of computers into the home, and it's almost the same thing, right? Where it's like games are a Trojan horse to have a computer, and this is like the third generation now of that yeah. being true. That's and true. Maybe it finally sticks this time.
And think of your average PC gamer at the time. You know, what were they playing? They were usually deep into, you know, something like Flight Simulator or you know, the I guess King's Quest, a Kalibeth style
like Bard's
RPG,
Tale or
Bard's
something.
Tale. Yeah, it was not. If you wanted to be a PC gamer at that time, you were really deep into these deep games. You were not interested in, you know, a little trifle. If you were a serious gamer at the time, reading like Computer Gaming World or something, you saw Minesweeper and Solitaire, and you were like, this is for the normies. This is something I'm going to spend 5 seconds on. But for all those new people getting, you know, Windows PCs at work, you know, I think at one point someone said their target market was the loosely supervised business person. So they weren't aiming for PC gamers. They were aiming for someone who's on their coffee break and they're like, I need something to take my mind off everything. Oh, there's a games folder in here. Solitaire, Minesweeper, things that you can get into in 5 seconds and not need a, you know, big instruction manual, not need to devote your life to it, to play a role. It's just like a simple Sudoku style puzzle that can take up a few minutes.
Well, and like Solitaire that's on there, I mean, that is an existing card game. That's not, right. You know, that wasn't invented for the computers. That's just a digital version of a thing that, like, I don't know, maybe they were already doing when they were born at their desk, you know?
Yeah, but it goes back hundreds of years. But if you take out a deck of cards and start playing it on your desk and the boss right. walks by, they're like, hey, you know, what are you doing? Oh, even if you're on your break, they'd be like, this looks bad. But if you have it on your monitor, and then when the boss comes by, oh, just minimize it, hit the boss button, whatever, and you're like, I got away with something.
So the entertainment pack, you know, is essentially a collection of these games that were sort of floating around on the inter-office network, sort of a best of mm-hmm. compilation of downtime games. And you know, of course, like once they're chosen, they have to be polished and finished and stuff. But mm-hmm. I think my favorite tidbit from the section of your book that we read is the compensation package to an employee for having their game chosen in the pack. Do you remember off memory? I have it written down if you don't. The exact compensation package.
It was 10 shares of Microsoft stock and a Turbo Express.
And a Turbo Express. The portable Turbo Graphics was given to the, what, like 10 people? Who?
Like, yeah, probably a dozen people or something. I don't know why. Maybe they thought this is the... I was probably the most, well, I mean, Neo Geo was maybe more expensive, but maybe they said like, this is the hottest, latest system at the
yeah,
time.
Hot
I don't know.
Right now in 1990.
yeah. I wonder what happened to those Turbo Expresses, if anyone.
Switches the day. Yeah.
But the 10 shares of Microsoft stock, you know, that's worth like six figures today if you kept it that whole time. But you know,
well, so it was a sealed and graded Turbo Express.
So. But think, I mean, as you true? Point out, like,
I don't know.
For that, whatever that six figure number was, I think it was like 160,000 or something like that.
Memory says 173. I want to see if
I think you might be right. I just remember it being something above 150,000. But as you point out in the book, you know, with the install base of Minesweeper, that right. is a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a penny. Per instance of Minesweeper on a computer. So
yeah, $200,000 $200,000 for 4 billion copies of a game. Not a great deal for the creators, but these were not, but these were not like storied game developers who were, you know, fighting for contracts. They were these were like free time games, and someone from Microsoft came to them and said, "Hey, can we use this for a Windows Entertainment Pack?" And they were like, "Yeah, I coded it, you know, using your computers. I guess it belongs to you." You know, they weren't really thinking. The creators of this game were not like, "This is going to become a household name. This is going to distribute to billions of people, and it's going to."
No, what they're thinking is, "Oh man, I can play Keith Courage on the toilet."
I want that Bonk's Adventure. Yeah. It's weird too, because so one of the creators sadly passed away a few years before I was started writing the book, but the other one, Robert Donner, I talked to him about it, and you know, I think if I made a game that everyone knew, like Minesweeper, or that had been billions of copies, hundreds of millions of players, I'd be like, "Oh yes, you know, thank you. I really worked hard on it. I'm very proud that people like it. I'm glad I could bring some joy to their day," you know, whatever. He's like, "I think my work on Microsoft Office was more important. I'm sad that I wasted so many people's time with such a simple game." You know, this is not a thing that the creators were really proud of, or that they, you know, bring up as, you know, the first thing on their resume. It was just a one-off for them that kind of grew into a huge phenomenon. So I found that interesting.
So the Entertainment Pack, the first one, this is a box product. We're not talking about, you know, games embedded with Windows and or downloadable. That's barely a thing.
Right.
This is a box retail product, and it just barely made it out.
Yeah, there was a lot of resistance inside Microsoft. There are a few quotes in the book about people who are like, "This is going to ruin our reputation. We are not a games company. We are, you know, a serious company for serious business people. We make Office and DOS and, you know, Microsoft Excel and Word." And, you know, I think Microsoft Office costs, you know, easily hundreds or thousands of dollars for a multi-site license at this point. You know, it was an enterprise company. So for them to consider, to pitch to the higher ups, we're gonna make this fun game collection, that it just, a lot of people really thought it did not fit with the Microsoft brand, to the extent where they're like, this is going to be damaging. You have to stop. And, you know, thankfully, you know, partly because of Bill Gates's addiction to Minesweeper, I think it kind of pushed it along. And, you know, most people thought like, "Hey, you know, just let them do their little thing. It's not going to be a big deal." But it's just a culture mismatch, I guess. So you have this small entry business unit that sees it as a wedge to get these products into interesting to kids and into homes. And there's this behemoth, Microsoft's already a behemoth at this point, servicing businesses and, you know, contractors that are buying tens, hundreds of thousands of dollars of PCs. And they're like, "This is just a waste of time at best. This and actively harmful to us at worst." So, it just kind of sneaks out. I think also what convinced these naysayers a little bit is Solitaire shipped with Windows 3.0. And there's a few quotes in the book where when people talked about Windows 3.0, they didn't talk about any of the new features, you know, minimizing, multitasking, whatever. All anyone could talk about was Solitaire. It's like, this is amazing. You know, I've spent so many hours on Solitaire. It's a thing they just threw in at the last minute, but it became the lasting image. And I don't know if you guys have played the original version of Solitaire, but you remember the cascading cards thing when you win the game, where the cards kind of bounce down. And that, I don't know, that was like the amazing victory cutscene of its day. I don't think there's anything comparable. People would gather around monitors to look at this, and they'd be like, "Whoa, you know, this is the glitz and glamour of Windows, I guess." You could probably do that in DOS games, but this was a thing that was on every Windows computer. Like, "Oh man, I gotta play this. I want to get that bouncing card thing." It's like a little shot of endorphins. in your day.
It's like that silent film with the train coming at the screen. And everyone jumps.
These cards are going to bounce out and hit me in the face, Soda.
It's funny. I only ever thought of the bouncing cards as like, because I did, like, if I won a game of solitaire, I would just kind of leave that up on my computer screen. Right. But it wasn't like a wow, look what computers can do. It was like, look what I can do. Yeah. I did that.
Yeah,
I'm smart enough to solve solitaire.
That's true. I don't think many people, you know, skipped that cutscene and started a new game. I think everyone kind of let let it play out, right? You got to see that through.
That's your victory march. Yeah.
It's,
you gotta at least like get up and go take a walk around the room or something, you know, do your victory laps.
I would get twitchy if someone like cut that off or closed the window. I think I would get a little twitchy. I'd be like, you gotta finish it. Like, it's not quite OCD, but I would feel weird about it.
I am looking at the retail packaging for the first print of Microsoft Entertainment Pack for Windows, and I find this very funny.
I have a copy sitting right here next to me. Yeah,
this is like when you watch like an animated Christmas special and the idea of toys is like wooden soldiers and cars. That's just what this is like a snapshot of the 1950s.
Yeah, that,
like what someone who was old in 1990 thinks toys are. So
yeah, these are the toys in your grandma's attic that are left over from your mom's childhood. They're what's left over at the beach house.
Because literally marbles, tanker toys.
It's like a die-cast car.
Yeah, a die-cast car from like the 40s.
Yeah. Dominoes.
Yeah. I think there's a jack in there. Half of this stuff is definitely made of lead and should not be put in your mouth. Like, it's just... I don't know. I think there's a deck of Nintendo Hanafuda cards from the 1800s in there. If you look in the corner, probably. Like, not literally. don't go looking for that weird Easter egg, everyone. It's just like it's just the perfect visual snapshot of how Microsoft was not a fun company.
Yeah, this kind of speaks to the cultural mismatch. They're like, oh, what are we going to do to get people to pick this up on the store shelves when it's going to be sitting next to, you know, productivity software or Word. Oh, let's put dominoes on there. Let's put marbles.
Everything, tanker toys.
Everything people remember from their youth. It's fun, right? And that was the very first version. You know, I think they updated that with a more. You remember those 90s like the jazz cups with the purple and blue zigzag type thing that you would see at fast food. Yeah. That's the vibe I get from the subsequent Microsoft Entertainment Pack.
Well, yeah, the other one has got, you know, it's refined now, and there's nothing old fashioned on it.
It's very 90s version of Modernity. So,
but yeah, it's still minimal, but it's like a couple game boards, some cards, like a chess piece, like a D&D die. I don't know how many sided that is.
But it's like on a white background now.
Yeah,
it's
actually looks like. It's advertising some fun stuff. The other one, it's a photograph of grandpa's attic.
It's not a badly lit attic anymore. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's even like dingy in there, which is
like
on top of it, just having old fashioned toys. It also literally looks like it was taken in like a dusty, dark attic.
You know,
the only light source is like, are you all looking at it right now?
Mm-hmm.
It's just like there's a little bit of light kind of on the marbles. It's like the shutters are closed, but there's just a little bit of light peeking from the edge. You know,
I think they were really
a little stripe on grandpa's desk next to literally the paper airplane that's sitting there.
I think they were really trying to sell the gritty realism of the Microsoft Entertainment Pack. You know, you really want to feel the dust and the grime. I don't know.
It looks like an Unreal Engine 5 Microsoft Entertainment Pack. Yeah.
Yeah. We need the photorealistic version of Minesweeper now, where you actually, you know, see a photograph of a mine there. But yeah, people talk about this in the book. It's how, you know, that the product team, that the packaging team really didn't understand what was going on here. There were also some economic issues. You know, apparently every Microsoft product at the time came with support. You know, you could call this 800 number or 900 number or whatever and get support, and that would be billed back to, you know, the unit that made the product. And it was some exorbitant amount of money that would be charged back for every call that you get.
I believe it was $40.
You mean per call?
Yeah.
I don't remember the specifics. So.
Yeah. I bet all of my numbers are wrong, but today I feel like I somehow have weird number retention from yesterday. So let's just roll.
Okay. So let's just say $40. And you know, if it's a site license for Office that, you know, people pay $10,000 for, then a few $40 support calls, that's fine. It comes out. Windows Entertainment Pack's a $40 product in itself. So if you get one phone call that like takes away all of the revenue you got from that sale. So they kind of came to this deal. They're like, the support staff are like, we don't want this stupid game product clogging up our important Microsoft Word and Windows Excel calls. And the people at the entrance business unit are like, we don't want that either because it's going to cost our unit a lot of money and we're not going to make any revenue. So what they said is, okay, how about if there's nothing in the queue, if you've solved every Office issue, every Microsoft Excel issue, every Windows bug in the phone queue, then you can pick up any Microsoft Entertainment Pack related calls. And they were like, and you know, the support people were like, oh, fine, you know, we'll never answer your support calls. Ha ha ha. And the entry business people were like, oh, thank you. Never pick up our calls, please. We do not want to be billed for this. So kind of worked out for everybody in that sense. But that just, you know, goes to show you what a mismatch it was. You know, it was, There's a tale about the cost of the packaging and the instruction booklets. It had to be, I don't know, maybe you remember the number, Frank, but some percentage of the sale price was the maximum.
12%. That's what I wrote down because I thought that was interesting, that Microsoft just had a blanket, like your cost of the product can only be 12% of the sale price. Right. Which is like incredibly good margins, by the way. That's crazy.
Yeah. Well, that's the physical product could only be 12%. And that includes the box and the cost of making the discs and putting a sticker on the discs and writing an instruction manual. And, you know, that could add up because, you know, Microsoft Office came with like this 200-page manual describing everything you could do with it. But for a $40 product, 12% is just a few dollars. And, you know, you need a few cents for the discs, you need a few cents for the cardboard box. And when they were getting down to it, they were like, we need an instruction manual.
There's cardboard box is a dollar.
Yeah, something like that.
Testing our numbers here.
Yeah, I've forgotten all these numbers now. But but they were like, but you need an instruction manual. You need something in there. And they're like, we don't have money for an instruction manual. We especially nothing approaching what you guys think of an instruction manual. So like really late in the process, there's a story of them running to Kinko's with like this thing they wrote overnight, basically like, you know, type setup.exe and, you know, how to play Minesweeper, click new game and then play Minesweeper. You know, it's really nothing in there. And it was like two of these per sheet of loose leaf paper. He went to Kinko's, printed out tens of thousands of copies, cut them by hand. And, you know, then he takes it to the manufacturing department and he hands them this crate of paper to put in the boxes. And there's this anecdote about the guy at this thing picking, he's used to these 200 page manuals. He's picking up this half sheet of paper and kind of waving it in his hand and be like, wow, you really went all out with this one. And yeah, it's the kind of thing where Microsoft really didn't know what to do with a product that was this far from their wheelhouse.
Well, they just were not set up for this at all. This is like an enterprise software company. I don't really know that they had any products at that consumer price point at that time. Do you even know, Kyle?
No, I don't think so. Even other games were usually a little more expensive than this. So this was kind of seen as a value proposition. Oh, you're getting, what is it, six games and a screensaver for $40 rather than just one game. And, you know, they're not deep, you know, role-playing games or something, but you could kind of sell that as a value thing. But no, it's hard to think of now when we think of Microsoft as the Xbox company and, you know, Microsoft Game Studios is this huge thing. You could see this as kind of the precursor to that, kind of proving, oh, okay, we can make games and leads to DirectX, leads to the Xbox 10 years later. You know, you could draw a dotted line from the Windows Entertainment Pack and Minesweeper to every Microsoft gaming initiative that came after.
So, I mean, how does Minesweeper move from being in like the Microsoft Entertainment Pack to being its own thing just on every computer?
This is one of the most frustrating parts of my research. I really wanted to find the person who's like, we want Minesweeper on Windows 3.1 and, you know, set off the chain reaction of billions of copies. And, you know, I dug as deep as I could. You know, this is, you know, one of the creators of the game is dead already. A lot, and the people who were around Microsoft at the time, their memories are not always focused on what happened in the early 90s anymore. This is a 30-year-old events. And everyone I talked to who was there, they were like, it was a real dead end for any details. You know, the people on the entry business unit were like, oh, someone from the operating system came over and said, we're taking Minesweeper. And that was that. And then I looked for people in the operating system side, and they were like, yeah, I don't really remember it being a big deal. Someone just said we should have Minesweeper at one point, and we did it. But no one had any details. No one really thought, oh, okay, we need something in addition to Solitaire, and Minesweeper is going to, you know, balance it out or this or that. It was just,
in my experience, it probably is actually just that boring.
I mean, maybe there is no story to tell there, but I really wanted someone to say, oh, I remember I was hooked on Minesweeper and I thought, you know, we need something to sell Windows 3.1 and, you know, we already have Solitaire. I don't know. I'm making up stories now, but I was hoping that was going to be, you know, a core part of the book. Like, here's the person responsible for 4 billion copies of Minesweeper, and no one really knows, or no one I could find remembers how that happened, unfortunately.
Yeah, if you even found that guy, I bet, you know, you'd have to explain it and be like, oh, that's interesting. Anyway, did you ever see in Excel when you could like do a sum command? That was me.
That could be the same thing. There was some I did find, talking to these people, there was some conflict between the operating system people and the entry business people about this. When they took Minesweeper, you know, they were still trying to sell at the Entertainment Pack. They were trying to sell games.
Well, they took his success away from him. Yeah,
pretty much. You know, well, Minesweeper, you know, was one of the biggest parts of the Entertainment Pack, and it was selling hundreds of thousands of copies to OEMs and whatnot. And they take away Minesweeper and they're like, oh, okay, we'll give you, you know, a few cents, a few dollars per install. We'll give it to the entry business unit, apparently. But the entry business unit people I talked to are like, oh, these operating system folks, they feel like these games just come from space. They could take whatever they want. So there's some internal drama there where, you know, they did all the legwork. They proved that gaming was a thing. And then the OS folks are like, yeah, okay, we'll take your best bit. And now it's part of Windows and, now, it's ours now.
Well, don't worry. 33 years later, and all of Microsoft's divisions have learned to synchronize and communicate with each other, and it's never been an issue since then. So we're good now.
Well, it you know, I'm trying to imagine like if Windows came to, you know, the gaming side and be like, oh, hey, yeah, we're going to include Halo with, you know, every Windows operating system now. You're not going to sell Halo anymore. It's not going to be part of Game Pass. It's just going to be built into Windows 11.
I guarantee they have said that and been turned down.
Well, I mean, I think now the gaming people could be like, you know, no, we're a major part of this company. Yeah. But back then, they were like, you know, the entry business unit, you know, who cares about you?
There are definitely people at the OS unit who think Halo came from space.
And I mean, in a sense, it did. That's
whoa. Makes
that's
you
deep, man.
I almost got the drum thing off in time.
This is a Zencaster drum. There
yeah,
it is.
But yeah, but it.
You can add that in and post.
That's there. It's there.
It's there. I'm not really used to like producing. I'm just here to speak. Okay, so I mean, in researching this book, like already, I was just really excited when I heard that this is one of the titles of the books because it's
me too. Yeah.
It's very unexpected. And my first thought was like, what is the crediting for this game like? Like, was it actually easy to figure out who made Minesweeper?
Yeah, there's so the actual creators are noted in the help files.
That's pretty good for that time period in video games.
I am kind of surprised that they did. I think they did that for all the Windows Entertainment Pack products. You can still, you know, find these people if they're around and willing to talk about it. But then, you know, I went, I that was a starting point, but then you know, in I think in the help file for one of the prototypes for Minesweeper, it says based on the Mac version by Dan Griscom, or I might be misremembering that name. And I was like, oh, what? The Mac version? Who's that? I thought, you know, and then I looked at that and say, oh, that, and it says somewhere that it was inspired by another version. And there was a really great website. It used to be at minesweeper.info. Now it's at minesweepergame.com, the authoritative Minesweeper, which was invaluable in this research. This is a passion project of one guy who started it in, you know, web 1.0 days of like 1999, 2000, and has kind of been chronicling the evolution of Minesweeper and Minesweeper-like games, both before and after the Windows version. He's also very focused on the competitive scene of Minesweeper, people going for high scores, which is a major part of the book that I get into, people exploiting random number generators to get ever lower times and the kind of existential crisis it causes in the community. But that was a great starting point for the research because I was finding all these versions I'd never heard of, people to reach out to, the people at Microsoft that I had to track down through LinkedIn, and kind of, you know, I had to bug some of them for a few months before they would answer. And there was a wide range of reactions. Some of the people were like, you're writing about Minesweeper? I remember working on it, but it wasn't a big deal to me. And then there were other people who were like, yeah, finally, someone's talking about Minesweeper. I was really jazzed about this. This is one of my favorite parts of my career. I'm gonna talk to you for 2 hours and just be super excited the whole time. I think that's a rambly answer to your question, I guess, about the process of tracking them down.
No, we like rambly answers here. I don't know. I'm thankful that that so many people were willing to speak to you, especially because, like you mentioned, a lot of these people were they're probably in very high places now because they like mm-hmm. created Excel or whatever, you know. So it seems like, you know, I've run into this in my research too, where it's like, you've done much more important things than the thing I want to talk to you about, but do you have 5 minutes to talk to me about, you know, this minor stepping stone in your career? And I don't think Minesweeper is by any stretch of the imagination a minor stepping stone, because mm-hmm. it is so everywhere.
Right.
But I guess, you know, if you're coming from a like business software background and rising the ranks at Microsoft, that you might feel that way.
I don't think it's any different than like a musician who has an entire body of work and they became known for writing a commercial jingle, you know, like that became their most famous. Like, I mean that, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of the same thing, right? Where it's like, yeah, I did that, but that was just kind of something I did between like my passion projects, right? It'd be like, you know, if one of us got famous for, I don't even know, I can't think of what one of us might become famous for that has nothing to do with our work. It's like, yeah, but I did, what about my stuff? You know, that was just something I did on the side. It was like,
what if you coined the term Metroidvania and then you wrote a bunch of other stuff, but everyone remembers you? Hi
that's
Jeremy,
actually a really good comparison, right? It's like, oh, you're the Metroidvania guy.
Hi Jeremy,
what you're known for, right? Yeah, like that's maybe the closest we can get, because Jeremy's, I'm sure, feeling is like, well, yeah, but what about how I pioneered mm-hmm. the way that we write critically about games?
Exactly. You know, I really would have loved to talk to like Bill Gates about his Minesweeper obsession and be like,
you would have been into it too, and that's the frustrating part.
I mean, yeah.
I know when you know that someone actually would talk to you if you could just get to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I maybe I'll keep trying, but yeah, it was not going to happen.
You could release an addendum, right? It's like
the Bill Gates interview, version 2.
But I agree that that's got to be really frustrating, because it's like, if you saw Bill Gates at a party or something, right?
That would be like, my intro. Like, hey, I wrote a book about Minesweeper. You remember that?
He would be like, oh, yeah, let me talk to you about this. Yeah.
If I ever run into him at a party,
okay,
that'll be my opener.
Good deal.
But, you know, I think something I know you guys talk about a lot is the people who were involved in this early video game history are not going to be around forever. Mm-hmm. And even if they are, they're not going to remember what they did or have their, you know, design documents or emails around anymore. So if we're going to capture this history, time is ticking a little bit. So I felt like I had to get some of these people are, you know, getting up in years or have sadly passed away. And I wanted to get their remembrances now when it was available and find what interesting stories I could. And, you know, once I started digging into it, when I first thought about Minesweeper as a book, like I said, I wanted to write about it because there hadn't been much written about such a big game. But I was like, well, is there anything interesting here? Is it going to really sustain a book? And then once I started digging into it, even before I interviewed people, I was like, yeah, wow, there's a lot of angles here that I hadn't considered, as business history, as the competitive history of the game, people who really got obsessed with it. And also there's a whole section about a moral panic that evolved around games like Minesweeper and Solitaire, just because they were built into Windows. You know, every Windows machine in every office now had games on it, and managers and even politicians were worried that, like, this, we bought this $2,000 computer to help your productivity, and you're saying now you're going to waste time with games on it. We have to do something about this. So major corporations and politicians are go out about banning games in one way or another. There was an effort by a senator to ban games from any government-owned computer, federal government-owned computer. And I go into all this in a lot of detail in the book, but it was fascinating to me. You think of, you know, Doom, Mortal Kombat as like the games people are worried about in the 90s, but even something simple like Solitaire or Minesweeper, if it goes against the cult of productivity, you're also going to get people up in arms about a simple video game.
Well, don't worry. Games won. We all have them in our pockets all the time now. We don't have to carry around our dominoes like in the old days.
I mean, our box of tin cars. And,
yeah.
Once everyone got internet access at their computers at work, I think that really kind of overtook any worries about, you know, Solitaire. But there was it was that weird period from like 1990 to 1998 where this was like public enemy number one for some people.
It's so interesting to me how a lot of the actual most prolific games, how long it took for people to actually study them because they're not part of the traditional video game narrative. Barbie fashion designer comes to mind for me is like, you know, the exclusive domain of Rachel Weil being interested, right? Even Carmen Sandiego.
I was going to bring up Carmen Sandiego and what you've done with that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, yeah, sure. I did a weird footnote part of it. Fine. But, you know, like Kate Willert has been like asking the questions no one asked for some reason, you know, and trying to piece it together herself. It's, you know, I'm sure there's more examples of this. Like I don't know who made Mavis Beacon teach us typing, you know, but that was like everywhere. And I don't know. I guess I don't know what this makes me think other than like, God, there's so much unexplored territory. Like we've not begun to tell the story of video games unless video games to you is the console wars of the 1990s, in which case we have told that to death. Please stop.
Yeah. And it's kind of,
I don't know. I hesitate to even say that because I think that there's still a lot of angles that go unexplored in a lot of video game history. And something I appreciate about your book, Kyle, is, you know, and I think it almost requires a like simple game to start thinking in these terms, because there is so much to tell about, like Doom or Nintendo or whatever, like, but I don't think a lot of people start exploring beyond the like literal making of and maybe reception. But, you know, the making of tends to be the like literal game designers and writers and stuff. And there's still not a lot of like marketing history out there in video games or PR history or, you know, like we talked about this last episode, but like, you know, I interviewed a logo designer recently, and Jack Yarwood was, you know, has written several articles about logos now. And it's like, I think still a lot of like weird angles like that, that are going kind of unexplored. And I'm happy that, you know, I think you probably had to with something like Minesweeper, where it's just like, you gotta go further than just like, this was made. You got to be like, okay, but like, how did that affect society and, you know, the competitive scene and that sort of thing?
Yeah, you do. You, it's kind of the legacy of this game. If this book was the making of Minesweeper, I don't know, 10 pages, it's like, you know, I did it in a weekend. It was based on these earlier games, you know, and you can go a little bit into that. But yeah, it's the legacy of this game, and it's such a generational thing. You know, Frank, you said early at the beginning, like, I hope everyone listening has played this game, is aware of this game. But when I talk to people about it, you have to have been in a certain place and time to really be part of the Minesweeper generation, to really be someone who was introduced to Windows PCs in the 90s, was obviously exposed to this. But if you're younger than that, or older than that, even, maybe you're like, oh, I've heard of Minesweeper, or you know, my dad talks about that game, about wasting time with that game, but I never really figured out how to play it. So I'm really, in the book, I really tried to capture what it was like in that pre-internet time. You know, I think there were like a few hundred DOS games released in 1990. And that was the entirety, according to Moby Games, and that was the entirety of PC gaming at the time. And, you know, today, just on Steam, it's like 10,000 or more games a year. And that's just one platform. That's not even talking about that's not even talking about mobile. That's not even talking about consoles. Right. And it's just overwhelming. So trying to get people who didn't live it into that headspace of what gaming was just 30 years ago took a lot of effort in the book. I feel I really tried to capture, like, get your head into this space, and where Minesweeper, you know, you look at it today and you're like, really, this is what people got excited about, this is what people got addicted to. But yeah, because it was there, it was the one they had access to, it was the one game that was pre-installed, and you didn't have to go to a store and buy it, and you didn't have to read a big manual. It was like the first casual game, you know. So just if you didn't live it, you don't know, I guess. I sound a million years old right now. That's kind of how I feel.
It's important that you know what it was like to be me.
I was walking up five miles in the snow, uphill both ways, to go to the game store and buy my copy of King's Quest.
Do you understand me yet?
Right, get off my lawn.
Cool. Well, I think that about wraps it up today on the Video Game History Hour. Kyle, we'll go ahead and link to where people can purchase the book. But for those listening, where can they find you on the internet?
I'm on Twitter for now at Kyle ORL. As long as Twitter's existing, I also still write for
the evolution of this outro lately. Like, this is just what everyone does now. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm also the senior gaming editor at Ars Technica, where I've been for over a decade now, which feels like 10 lifetimes in the world of video game media. So I'm really happy they're still letting me write good stuff over there. And you'll have the link to Boss Fight Books. Check out the book. Check out the whole season. And Kelsey's book on Animal Crossing, I'm sure, is going to be great as well.
And I already read it. It is.
Glad to hear an unbiased opinion there.
Completely unbiased.
Completely. All right, Kyle. Thanks a lot. It's been a pleasure. Let's have you back sometime.
It's been fun.
Thanks for listening to the Video Game History Hour, brought to you by the Video Game History Foundation. If you have questions or comments for the show, you can find us on Twitter at Game History Hour or email us at podcast@gamehistory.org. Did you know that the Video Game History Foundation is a 501c3 nonprofit and that all of your contributions are tax deductible? You can support this podcast and all of our other work on Patreon or at gamehistory.org/donate. This episode of the Video Game History Hour was produced by Robin Kunimune and edited by Michael Carroll. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.